So yeah, this paper is a result of me kind of always had the suspicion of evolutionary debunking arguments and trying to put my finger on what I think is wrong with them. And rather annoyingly, once I'd done that and rewritten the paper several times, another paper now exists that sort of argues something vaguely similar to what I'm arguing. But I think it's importantly different from what I'm going to say today. I'm not going to address that directly because I don't want to like rewrite the whole talk, but if anyone wants to ask about that in the Q&A, then please feel free. Okay, so according to a common form of argument, if there's a plausible evolutionary backstory that would explain our moral beliefs, this is going to make trouble for moral realists in that it would commit them to a kind of unappealing pessimism about the prospects of moral knowledge. And arguments that take this form are known as evolutionary debunking arguments, or EDAs, as I'll call them today. And in this paper, I'm going to argue that evolutionary explanations of our moral beliefs don't, in fact, have any bearing on their epistemic status. And I think, you know, perhaps there are other reasons to think that realism has trouble accounting for moral knowledge, but if I'm right, evolutionary explanations aren't among them. They don't provide any additional reason to worry. What I'm going to argue is that these EDAs exploit an equivocation between two distinct readings of their central evolutionary claim. One reading, I'm going to say, is plausibly true but has no epistemic relevance, and the other would have epistemic consequences for realism, but I'm going to argue it's not plausible. So I'm going to begin by saying in more detail what moral realism is and what EDAs are and how I think they equivocate. And then I'm going to look in detail at a number of different EDAs. I'm going to argue one by one that they all face the same problem. So to start with, I'm just going to define realism as any view that holds these three tenets. So moral statements have truth conditions, at least some moral statements are true, and the truth values of moral statements are relevantly independent of the attitudes of even idealized agents. I'm not going to say a huge amount of this, about this. I don't take this to be particularly controversial. Some people think that there are stronger forms of realism that are particularly susceptible to EDAs. And some people think, for example, that we might want to add a fourth claim that the truth of moral statements isn't reducible to the truth of any natural statement. And I'm not going to take a stand really on this, but if you think that there is a version of realism that's particularly susceptible to EDAs, I want you to read me as saying that even that form of realism is going to survive EDAs. Okay. So what EDAs I think have in common is the following bit of core reasoning. So they all begin with what I'm calling the evolutionary backstory claim, which is the claim that our moral beliefs have been shaped by natural selection. Normally when people make this point, they sort of specify that they mean that the way in which our moral beliefs have been shaped by natural selection is indirect. So most debunkers don't think that we're born having the moral beliefs that we have. They think that we inherit dispositions to have certain moral beliefs, and that those can be explained by natural selection. And I take them to be saying that creatures that have these dispositions that underlie these moral beliefs are, all things being equal, much more likely to survive and reproduce than creatures that lack them. And so in this sense, natural selection indirectly explains our moral beliefs. We have the moral beliefs that we have because those are the ones that go with the fitness-enhancing dispositions. Okay, so if you add to that claim the further claim that natural selection is indifferent to the truth of these beliefs, and I think this is a claim that I think realists are going to have to accept, because realists think that the truth of moral beliefs is going to be a matter of how mind-independent moral reality is, And it looks like the question of the accuracy with which our beliefs represent mind-independent moral reality is going to be an entirely separate question from the question of how fitness-enhancing those beliefs or the dispositions underlying them are. The worry is, according to debunkers, that once you put these two together, it looks like it's going to follow that our moral beliefs have been shaped by forces that are indifferent to their truth, because they've been shaped by natural selection, and natural selection is indifferent to their truth. And I think that this looks epistemically worrying in two distinct ways. I think debunkers don't normally distinguish between these two ways, but I think they are two importantly different complaints. So one complaint is, well, look, it looks very unlikely that beliefs that have been shaped by forces that are indifferent to their truth are going to be true. So actually both worries have that at their core. But one way of taking this is, well, seeing as truth plays no role in our acquisition of moral beliefs, it's going to be very unlikely that our moral beliefs are going to be true. And so they can't be knowledge because they're not, you know, it's not likely that they're true. That it's implausible that they're true, so it's implausible that we have more knowledge. But another kind of complaint is that the fact that it's very unlikely for them to be true means that even if they were true, they're not going to be knowledge because, you know, if they're true, they're true by some amazing fluke, and something that we get right by amazing fluke isn't going to be knowledge. So I think these are two related but importantly distinct worries about our moral beliefs under realism. Okay, so my claim is going to be that arguments of both kinds suffer from this equivocation that I mentioned before. So let me tell you what the equivocation that I think is going on is. So I've mentioned this EB claim, which is playing a pivotal role in evolutionary debunking arguments. This again is a claim that our moral beliefs have been shaped by natural selection. And debunkers tend to phrase it that way. They talk about us and our moral beliefs. But I think there's two different readings of this. So the predicative reading, what I'm calling the predicative reading, takes the EB claim to be predicating something of each individual. It's saying that you and I and everybody else have each individually been caused to accept the moral beliefs we accept by the forces of natural selection. So that's one reading, and now here's an importantly different reading. On this other reading, what's being said when we say our moral beliefs have been shaped by natural selection is that the fact that the world contains many individuals who have these moral beliefs and not very many individuals who don't is explained by natural selection. Because individuals who have those beliefs generally have more offspring, leading to a situation where more and more individuals with these beliefs exist, and individuals without those beliefs make up a smaller part of the population, eventually leading to a situation where the vast majority, at least, of individuals have these beliefs. What I'm going to argue... just briefly, I'm calling this a quantificational reading because quantifiers include not just all and some, but many and most. And I think what's being explained here is the fact that many humans who have these, that there are many humans who have these beliefs, but most humans have these beliefs. But here's the important thing. So something can be an explanation of this quantified claim without being an explanation of why any particular individuals have these beliefs. Because it can be an explanation of why the world contains individuals, those individuals, and not others, rather than an explanation of why those particular individuals have those beliefs. Now, I think this predicative quantification ambiguity happens in lots of different cases. It's not restricted just to evolutionary cases. So here's an example that comes from Elliot Sober. So he talks about, imagine there's a classroom, and the classroom contains some kids, and all of them can read at grade 3 level. Now, you might ask, what explains why these kids can all read at grade 3 level? Now, one explanation that you could give would be if it was a criterion of admission to the classroom to be able to read at grade 3 level. That, you know, no child would be admitted if they couldn't read at grade 3 level. And in some sense, that explains why all the kids in that classroom can read at grade 3 level. But suppose that classroom contains, you know, Charlotte and Sophie and James, you know, you might say, okay, well, we haven't really explained why Charlotte can read at grade 3 level or why James can. We've just explained why the classroom contains kids who have that ability. And so, look, this looks like a case where we've done an explanation of in the quantificational sense, but not in the predicative sense. That explanation can leave you none the wiser about, you know, whether it's because they had supportive parents, or they had lots of access to books, or they're just naturally very clever, blah, blah, blah. And here's another example. So Sarah is an interior designer. All her clients live in New York's Upper East Side. You might ask what explains that. Suppose it turns out that she only advertises there, so that no one who didn't live in the Upper East Side would have heard of her. Again, that doesn't explain why, like, Alan and Greg live in the Upper East Side. It just says why her client base consists only of people who live there. So again, I think you can have quantification explanations that aren't explanations in the predicative sense. Okay, so how does this bear on EDAs? I'm going to say that the reasoning in 1 to 3, that central core piece of reasoning that EDAs share, is different depending on which reading you take of the EB claim, the evolutionary backstory claim. So the predicative version of the argument would say, you and I and everyone else have each individually been caused to accept the moral beliefs that we accept by the forces of natural selection, or seeing as that's indifferent to the truth of these beliefs, we've individually, you and I and everyone else, been caused to accept the moral beliefs we accept due to forces indifferent to their truth. And you can see how that might be epistemically worrying, but I think it's hard to see why we should take the predicative reading to be plausible. And here's three reasons. So The bunkers haven't given us any reason to accept the predicative claim. What they say in support of EV normally looks like support for the quantification reading. So here's Sharon Street trying to support the EV claim. So she says it's fairly obvious why, other things being equal, ancestors with these evaluative tendencies would have left more descendants than counterparts who, for example, view their survival as bad, their children's lives as worthless, or the fact that someone who had helped them as a reason to hurt that person in return. So it looks like this is an explanation. This looks like it's an argument for the EV claim in the quantificational sense. It looks like it's an argument for thinking that the natural selection explains why the world contains so many individuals who have these beliefs. Not an explanation for why any particular individuals came to have these beliefs. Okay, so that's one reason I think that it's the quantificational reading that we should be taking, not the predictive reading. Second, claims about evolutionary backstories are, in general, quantificational claims. So, giraffes have long necks. If someone said that has an evolutionary backstory, normally what they'd be saying is that, look, the ones that have long necks have more offspring. And that led to lots of giraffes existing who have long necks, and not so many giraffes who don't, until you eventually get a situation where all of them do. And so I think the EV claim is similarly most naturally understood as a claim about the process that led to there being lots of individuals who have these beliefs, not a claim about the process that led particular individuals to have the moral beliefs that they do. And finally, I think the predicative reading just doesn't have prima facie plausibility on its side. What would it even be for natural selection to push me or you or any other individual towards certain beliefs? So I think for these three reasons, the quantificational reading looks much more plausible. But if you look at the quantificational version of the argument, what we get to from the first two premises is that forces indifferent to moral truth have made it the case. Can anyone see this? Or is this in the way a little bit? Okay. Forces indifferent to moral truth have made it the case that the world contains many individuals who have these moral beliefs and not many individuals who don't. And that, to me, that just it's hard to see how that's going to generate the sorts of epistemic worries that the debunker thinks that they can get. But what I'm going to do in the remainder of this talk is to go through some particular EDAs in more detail and try and show that this just isn't going to generate the particular worries that debunkers think they can show the realists to have. So I'm going to talk about some warrant undermining arguments first, and then I'll talk about some truth undermining ones. And I'm going to look at four different epistemic defects that debunkers think that they can show on moral beliefs to have under realism. So here's the first epistemic defect. I think some people think that the causal origin of a belief can render it epistemically defective. And some debunkers have tried to use this claim in their EDAs. So here's Richard Joyce. He comes up with this example of suppose there were pills that made you believe that Napoleon lost the Battle of Waterloo. There's both. He's talking about both, but the relevant one is the one that makes you believe you lost. So I'm just going to summarise this because it's long. So imagine that you're proceeding through life happily believing that Napoleon lost Waterloo, as presumably you are, and then you discover that at some point in your past, someone definitely gave you one of these pills that makes you believe that Napoleon lost Waterloo. And Joyce thinks that that should undermine, the discovering that that's happened should undermine you're no longer warranted in having that belief. And I think some people want to say that not just discovering that that happened, but the very fact that it happened should undermine the warrant of your belief. Here's another example. So Matthew Bedker comes up with a similar example. So suppose this agent B is convinced that there's a goblin war going on all around her. It really seems to her this is the case, even though she strongly believes this, even though she also believes that she can't interact with the physical world. She has a very strong seeming that there's a goblin war happening. But then suppose that there's a causal explanation for why B has this belief. Suppose it turns out that she has a brain tumour in a particular part of her brain that has been known to cause similar effects in other patients. And the idea here is, well, shouldn't she give up her belief now that she knows this? And maybe she wasn't warranted at all, given that that's the causal backstory of her belief. Okay, So Joyce and Becker and others want to try and draw an analogy between Bee's case and the case of the person who's taken the Napoleon pill and ordinary moral believers. They want to say that the reasoning of 1 to 3 is going to show that our case is relevantly similar. Our situation with respect to our moral beliefs is relevantly similar to Bee's situation and to the person who's taken a Napoleon pill. And the idea is, well, look, it's got this faulty causal origin. There's this causal backstory for why we have the moral beliefs we have, and it has nothing to do with truth. And that looks like it's bad. It's going to be bad, given that we think that the case, the two other cases with the Napoleon pills and the Goblin War are also bad. Okay. And I think that they are wrong here. So the analogy with the Napoleon pills case and the brain tumour case, I think, relies on reading the EB claim in the predicative way. You know, quantificational reading of the EB claim says nothing about the causal process by which individuals form their moral beliefs. It's just a claim about the causal process that led to there being lots of individuals who have the beliefs in question. And the fact that that causal process has nothing to do with the truth of the beliefs, well, that doesn't look incompatible with what the realist wants to say, which is that the causal process that led each individual to his or her moral beliefs is an entirely epistemically respectful one. Now, I should add here that it's often remarked that the realist owes a positive account of how we come to know mind-independent moral facts. And a lot of people think this is a significant weakness for realism, that it's not clear how they can meet that challenge and it's going to be a significant problem. But this, even if that objection is compelling, that's not the objection that EDAs are pushing. So EDAs are saying that whatever other problems realists face, including perhaps that one about being unable to account for how we grasp moral facts, they also face further problems. That's what debunkers are saying. They face further problems beyond whatever other problems they face. And these further problems stem from the fact that our moral beliefs have an evolutionary explanation. So debunkers need to be saying that however it is realists think that we can come to know moral facts, evolutionary considerations show we can't be doing it. And if I'm right, the quantificational reading just doesn't succeed in showing this. Because it doesn't, the EB claim doesn't tell us anything about the causal origin for each individual of their belief, so it's just not relevantly similar to the B case or the Napoleon case. Okay. So here's another, actually a sort of set of three other potential epistemic defects that debunkers sometimes talk about, and these concern the counterfactual profile of our moral beliefs. So some EDAs argue that, you know, there's something about the evolutionary origin of our moral beliefs that just shows they have a kind of counterfactual profile which stops them from being knowledge. And you know, one version of this complaint is that our moral beliefs just don't vary across possible worlds with the moral facts. They vary with facts about what's fitness enhancing. So Neil Levi puts the point the following way. He says, we have no reason to think that our moral responses track genuinely moral features of the world. Instead, they're much more likely to track fitness-relevant features of our environment, which are not plausibly identified with moral features. And I think that this point has two components. So it has what I want to call a sensitivity component and a robustness component. So sensitivity, question about sensitivity is, would we give up our moral beliefs if they are false? You know, we want the answer to be yes. You know, if it turns out we wouldn't, that looks like a problem. And robustness, would we continue to hold our moral beliefs if some irrelevant factor were changed? Like their fitness enhancingness. And again, we want to say, if we're going to have moral knowledge, we need to be in a position to say yes, that they do have robustness. And the worry that the debunkers are raising is that maybe the evolutionary backstory of our moral beliefs just show that they can't have one or both of these components. But I think there's a third complaint that the debunkers sometimes make concerning the counterfactual profile of our moral beliefs, and that's that if facts about natural selection have been very different, we would have had very different, rather outlandish moral beliefs. And so I'm going to discuss these three complaints separately, and again I'm going to try and argue that they rely on reading the EB claim in a predicative way. If you read it in a quantificational way, you just can't get these worries. But one preliminary remark before I do that. So all three counterfactual requirements, these two plus the outlandishness worry, all of these are, I think, really most plausibly construed as only placing requirements on what we do with our beliefs in nearby possible worlds. So they're not going to require that, you know, in every possible world we keep hold of the belief where it's true and there's no possible world where we falsely believe it, etc., etc., because that just looks like deeply implausible and it's setting the bar far too high. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the robustness worry first. Some debunkers take 1 to 3 to show that our moral beliefs are insufficiently robust. Since, you know, by hypothesis, you know, their fitness producingness has nothing to do with their truth. And so it looks like, surely if we were to vary their fitness producingness, then we wouldn't believe them. And then it looks like we end up with the worry that they're not robust. And I think Sharon Street looks like she's making this kind of point here. So she says, since my normative judgments have been shaped by causes such as my upbringing, cultural background, and inherited psychological tendencies, it's clear to me that had some of these factors been different, I wouldn't have made the same set of normative judgments that I now make. I take it this inherited psychological tendencies thing looks like, you know, saying that if those had been different, I'd have different beliefs. That looks, I think, close enough to the robustness argument. Okay, so the success of the robustness argument is going to depend on two questions. So, first of all, is lack of robustness an epistemic defect? If the debunkers can show that our moral beliefs have it, will that be a problem? And second, can they show that our moral beliefs have it? Does that reasoning in 1 to 3 show that our moral beliefs lack robustness? Okay, so let's look at the first question first. Is lack of robustness an epistemic defect? Well, I'm not entirely clear that it is. So suppose I walk into a room and I see Maria, and she's wearing a red jumper that she's just about to leave. And on the basis of seeing her, I form the belief that she's wearing a red jumper. But obviously, if I walked in slightly later, I wouldn't have had the belief because I wouldn't have seen her. But I take it nothing follows from that about the epistemic status of my belief about Maria wearing a red jumper. It doesn't look like we want to say that there's something wrong with my belief because there's some counterfactual situation where I don't have it. So you might worry that lack of robustness might not even be an epistemic defect. But let's assume for argument's sake that we can pin down what robustness is in a way that doesn't entail that my Maria belief lacks robustness and makes it plausible that lack of robustness would be a defect. Let's consider whether 1 to 3 even shows that our moral beliefs lack robustness. Okay, so, well, first of all, you might worry that the possible world in which our moral beliefs aren't fitness producing doesn't look like a nearby one. But let's put that worry on hold, because there's, I think, another problem. So 1 to 3 read quantificationally, I think just doesn't show that our moral beliefs lack robustness. And again, so the predicative claim, it looks like, might show that. So if the only reason I have the moral beliefs I have is that they're fitness producing, and the only reason you do is that they're fitness producing, then it looks like, you know, had they not been fitness producing, then maybe we wouldn't have had them if that was the only reason why we had them. But again, you know, if we're reading it in the quantificational sense, it doesn't look like that's going to follow. So it's going to follow is, you know, take the moral beliefs that people in fact have. Natural selection has made it the case that the world contains many, many individuals who have those beliefs and not many who don't. Natural selection is indifferent to the truth of these beliefs, so we've got these forces indifferent to truth that have made it the case that the world contains lots and lots of people who have these moral beliefs and not many who don't. Okay, so what's the relevant counterfactual that you get from this? Well, presumably it's that if natural selection had gone differently, take some moral belief P, if natural selection had gone differently, such that that P, belief in P, wasn't fitness enhancing, then the world wouldn't contain many individuals who believe that P. And it might, in fact, contain lots and lots of individuals who don't believe that P. But I take it that doesn't show that my beliefs or your beliefs or anyone else's beliefs lack robustness, because in order to show that, it would need to be the case that you and I exist in that world and we're among these individuals who don't believe that P. And that's something that the debunkers just haven't shown. And I think actually the most natural way to think about this counterfactual scenario is not one in which you and I and everyone else exist and we lack the beliefs. It's as a situation where different people exist and they don't have the beliefs. And I think that's importantly different from the robustness worry. It doesn't show that any of our beliefs lack robustness. It's not even clear to me that it poses an epistemic problem for our beliefs. So I think most of us, you know, we might want to accept that modal facts about a given agent can bear on whether that agent's belief is knowledge, but it's not clear that facts about other possible agents and what they believe is going to bear on whether your belief is knowledge. And that's what we've got here, so it's just not clear we're going to get any epistemic worries from this talk. Okay, so let's go on to a third epistemic defect. This is susceptibility to outlandish moral beliefs. So I think a lot of debunkers reason along these lines. So Charles Darwin said that if humans had evolved more similarly to bees, then unmarried females would think that it was a sacred duty to kill their brothers, and mothers would kill their daughters, and no one would think of interfering. And Sharon Street makes a similar point about lions. If we'd evolved more similarly to lions, then we might have, you know, all these other kind of outlandish moral beliefs that you know we in fact find outlandish. Okay, so again, the question is going to be whether this would be an epistemic defect. If it turns out that we could have had outlandish moral beliefs, that bears on the epistemic status of the beliefs we in fact have. And second, whether 1-3 shows that our moral beliefs do have this defect. So first of all, on the question of whether susceptibility to outlandish beliefs would be a defect, well, it's not entirely clear to me what the worry is supposed to be, but here's one attempt to reconstruct it. So realists, or at least the ones who think we have moral knowledge, would have to say that the outlandish moral beliefs are false, otherwise the beliefs we in fact have are false. So then perhaps the worry is that if we could have had outlandish moral beliefs, we could have had a fortiori, we could have had false moral beliefs. And if it's true that we could have had beliefs that are not only false, but false in, you know, particularly out there kind of way, maybe that casts doubt on our being reliable believers with respect to morality. So I think that's my best guess at what the worry is here. That maybe, you know, if we could have had these crazy beliefs, then maybe we're just not in fact reliable believers. Okay, so let's suppose, for argument's sake, that that's true, that it would render our beliefs defective if this were the case. I want to argue again that the reasoning in 1-3 just doesn't show that we are susceptible to outlandish moral beliefs. And you can see how the predictive version of the argument would threaten to show that, because if I only believe what I believe, I only believe the moral beliefs that I have, because they're fitness-producing, then if other beliefs have been fitness-enhancing, then it looks like maybe I would have had those beliefs, same for you, same for everyone else. But we're not on the predictive version, because I've already suggested that really it's the quantification version that makes premise one plausible. But if we read the quantificational version, all we get is that if other beliefs, including really outlandish ones, have been fitness enhancing, the world will contain many individuals who have those beliefs and not many individuals who don't. But again, it's just not clear why we should worry about that. Why, as long as they're not us, and it doesn't look like there's any good reason to think that they are us, looks like what's happened is we've got a world populated by very different people with very different beliefs. And again, why should we think that the possibility of people who get things wrong should bear on whether we are reliable believers with respect to that subject matter? Okay, so fourth epistemic defect, this is the insensitivity worry. So some debunkers, many of them in fact, have tried to show that, or tried to argue that 1-3 shows that our moral beliefs are insensitive, that we would continue to hold them even if they were false. But there might be an easy way to avoid the sensitivity worry, because some people want to say they couldn't have been false. These moral truths are unnecessary, so there's just no possible world in which they're false. That's not the route I'm going to take. I'm going to take seriously the possibility that they could have been false, and I'm going to argue that the debunkers even then can't show that we would have continued to hold them in that situation. I'm not going to say much about whether insensitivity would be a defect. I think most people think it is. I find it plausible that it would be a defect if our moral beliefs were held in an insensitive way. But I'm going to argue instead that, read quantificationally, 1-3 just doesn't show that our moral beliefs lack sensitivity. So I think the debunkers have tended to assume that they can get the predicative version, and they have assumed that, well, sure, I mean, if I have the moral beliefs I have because they're fitness enhancing, then surely keep the fitness enhancing as the same, I'd still have them, even if they were false. But I take it that that's not really what's going on if it's the quantification version of EB that we're entitled to accept. What that shows, what EB read quantificationally shows, is not that individuals only have the moral beliefs they have because they're fitness enhancing. It just shows that people who have these moral beliefs, whatever their reasons for believing them in fact are, have tended to live longer and have more offspring, so that over time more and more people exist who have them. But beyond the dispositions being heritable and the beliefs being fitness enhancing, the EB claim just doesn't say anything about what these dispositions are that underlie our moral beliefs. And I take it that many different kinds of dispositions could play this role. And EDAs don't do anything to narrow down which ones are plausible to ascribe to us. And if that's right, then EDAs do nothing to rule out what the realist wants to say, which is that the disposition that plays this role, that underlies our moral beliefs, is a genuine ability to discern mind-independent moral facts. So agreeing with the EB claim doesn't force realists to give up on their claim that the disposition in question is a genuine ability to discern moral facts. Now, as I said before, there might be many other reasons to think that that view is implausible. So it might be that claiming that, you know, we have an ability to discern mind-independent moral facts is wildly implausible, and that realists have a significant burden of proof in trying to show that this view is indeed to be preferred to other alternatives. But that's not the worry, that's not the objection that EDAs are making. EDAs claim that in addition to whatever other problems realists face, there's a particular problem that stems from the fact that our moral beliefs have been shaped by natural selection. But if natural selection really does raise an additional epistemic problem for realism, debunkers need to show how natural selection rules out the realist's favourite picture, and it's not clear, at least from the sensitivity argument, that they can. Okay, so just to summarise so far, I've looked at four epistemic defects that debunkers have claimed that follow from the reasoning in 1-3, and I've argued that 1-3 read quantificationally just can't establish that our moral beliefs have any of these four defects. Moreover, I think there's reason to think that 1-3 understood quantificationally just can't bear on the epistemic status of our moral beliefs in any way, because 1-3 understood quantificationally fails to rule out the possibility that the disposition that underlies our moral beliefs is a genuine ability to discern more facts. And if it can't rule that out, it's hard to see how it can establish that there are any epistemic defects in our moral beliefs. So now I'm going to talk briefly about the other kind of EDA, the one that I've called truth undermining, the truth undermining EDA. So we've tried to look at kind of cases where debunkers are trying to show that our moral beliefs, even if they were true, can't be knowledge because they have something epistemically wrong with them. Now I'm going to look at arguments to try to show that they just can't be true. Okay, so I think that the thrust of the truth undermining EDAs is easiest to see when we consider moral believers third personally, because then we can separate the question from whether the beliefs are true from the question of whether the believers that we're talking about believe them. Okay. So what we've got here is these creatures' moral beliefs, whoever they are, have been shaped by natural selection. Natural selection is indifferent to the truth of these beliefs, so these creatures' moral beliefs have been shaped by forces that are indifferent to their truth. Okay, so one kind of way to argue from 1-3 star to the claim that these creatures' moral beliefs are unlikely to be true would be to take 1-3 star to show that our moral beliefs are epistemically defective in one of the ways discussed before, or maybe in some other way. In general, learning that someone has formed a belief in an epistemically defective way very often gives you reason to think that the belief is unlikely to be true. So Rothschild Philander makes this point. He says, suppose, for instance, that someone told you that there are exactly 5,422 billion fish in the world's oceans. You have no idea whether that number is even close. But then suppose you discover that this person landed on this figure by assuming, inexplicably, assuming that it was identical to the US trade deficit for 2011. And Shea Palambo points out, well, now you've got all you need in order to discredit this person's belief, even though you're in no position to verify the correct number. And I take it this is a case of showing that they form the belief in an epistemically defective way, so that's good enough to conclude that it's unlikely to be true. Now, I take it if we were to make a truth undermining argument that took that form, that tried to show the beliefs were defective and thus unlikely to be true, it would suffer from the same worries. If I've been right in what I've argued so far, it would suffer from the same worries as the warrant undermining ideas that we've talked about. But there's one other kind of truth undermining EDA that I think works in a different way, so isn't vulnerable to those objections. So here is this other truth undermining argument. So consider all the different moral beliefs that these creatures could hold, and then consider that the beliefs they do hold are the ones favoured by natural selection. And then also add the claim that natural selection is indifferent to whether the beliefs are true. Whatever beliefs natural selection favours, natural selection's favour in it, but has nothing to do with whether it's true. And since we know that these beliefs were favoured by natural selection, shouldn't that reduce our credence in the beliefs being true? Okay, I think lots of people make this argument, but I think the reasoning is faulty. So the situation described, I take it, is of the following kind. So suppose we're interested in whether some object O has a given property P, and we know that of all the different properties that O could have had, P is only one of many possible ones. In fact, there's many scenarios where O lacks P. And of all the many possible scenarios, there's only a very small proportion where O has P. Okay, so then suppose that you learn that O has some other property Q, and we know that Q is entirely independent of P. Well, I take it that, you know, scenario one, your credence that O has P should be low, because we've just stipulated that it's only one of many situations where, there's many situations where O lacks P and only a very small number where it has P. Suppose you learn that O has property Q, which is unrelated to P. Well, now what credence should you give to O having P? Presumably exactly the same, right? So O doesn't make the prospect of, sorry, learning that O has Q doesn't make the prospect of O having P any better. They were already bad. It doesn't, and then this doesn't make it any better, but it also doesn't make it any worse, because if Q is genuinely unrelated to P, it's not going to give you any reason to lower your credence that O has P. It just was low to start with. Here's another argument that takes this form. So suppose someone's picked out a card at random from a normal pack of cards. And suppose you're interested in whether the card is an ace. And there's loads and loads of different possible cards they could have picked. But then suppose it's revealed to you that the card is a heart. And obviously a card being a heart doesn't bear at all on whether it's an ace. It doesn't make it more likely, it doesn't make it less likely. So the discovery that a card is a heart shouldn't lower your credence that it's an ace, even though it shouldn't raise it. And I think that's also what's going on in the case of learning that our moral beliefs are fitness enhancing. Right? If the fitness enhancingness of a moral belief doesn't bear on whether it's true, then the discovery that these creatures' moral beliefs are fitness enhancing shouldn't lower our credence that they're also true, even though it shouldn't raise it. So the reason why the chances of the moral beliefs being true look so low in the first place was that the debunker was stipulating that the only thing relevant to determining whether these creatures' beliefs are true are evolutionary considerations. And sure, if you start out with that, then of course the chances of the belief being true is going to look very low. But again, learning that the beliefs were fitness enhancing isn't going to force you to lower your credence in any way. It's just going to be irrelevant. I think, how much time do I have?
You have 5 minutes.
Okay. I think that's enough to kind of discredit this argument, actually, that that learning that the beliefs are fitness enhancing shouldn't lower your credence that they're true. If fitness enhancing is genuinely unrelated, it would need to be that fitness enhancing is like inversely related to the chances of the beliefs being true. And no debunker is claiming that. And I think also, actually, I mean, I think that's enough to discredit the argument, but I also sort of wonder if the debunker is kind of begging the question against the realist here by stipulating that the only thing we have to go on in regarding the question of whether the beliefs are true is just evolutionary considerations. Because the realist is going to say that we actually have something else to go on. We have an ability to discern these moral facts. So if you're looking at these creatures and you're wondering if their moral beliefs are true, then one thing you could do is use your ability to discern the moral facts to find out whether their beliefs are the true ones. So I think there's something question-begging going on here as well. But even if you don't buy that bit of reasoning, I think the argument fails just on the basis that if fitness enhancing this is genuinely unrelated to the chances of the belief being true, that's not going to do any truth undermining. Learning that fitness enhancing isn't going to do any truth undermining work. Okay. I think that's everything. So just to sum up what I've argued, I've discussed two different kinds of EDAs. EDAs that try to show that our moral beliefs are unlikely to be true, and EDAs that try to show that our moral beliefs, even if they are true, we'd be getting them right by some massive fluke in our favour, and that's enough to show that we don't have warrant in believing them. And I've argued that these arguments fail, that debunkers have been trying to show that our moral beliefs have these kind of epistemic defects, But they're relying on an equivocation between two different ways of reading the claim that our moral beliefs have been shaped by natural selection. So on one kind of way of understanding it, if you're kind of not paying attention, it sounds like you're going, oh yeah, my moral beliefs, your moral beliefs, blah, blah, blah. And then we get the epistemic worries. We only have the beliefs because they're fitness enhancing. That definitely looks like a epistemically suspect. I've argued that that claim is not plausible, that only the only reason why anyone ever accepted the EB claim was because they're accepting the quantificational reading of it. Namely, that the reason why the world contains so many individuals who have these moral beliefs is that creatures that had the beliefs and the disposition underlying them reproduced more, so that there were, you know, each generation had more offspring who had the moral beliefs until you reach a situation where lots of people had them. And it's not clear that that's going to generate any epistemic worries.